Hey, you guys, welcome to part two here. So we're just going to continue our way through this discussion of worldview and discussing some of the cultural implications of various worldviews at play and just how those all take shape. So yeah, thanks for being here again for part two.
So what is our foundation and why do we need one? The fact is that it's true that some things contribute to human flourishing more than other things. I think we could all agree on that. And a big question here is, how do we want to measure human flourishing? And really, our worldview determines how we do that, how we measure it. And all worldviews have to answer the same fundamental questions in order to make sense of life and give us a roadmap to live by.
Yeah. So each worldview essentially aims to answer certain questions. So from the biblical vernacular, it would be the categories of creation, fall, and redemption. But really, any worldview's theory of origins is what we mean by creation. It's how to explain how everything came to be. It's to describe the uncaused cause. But this one, the worldview's theory of origins, will have direct implications about human nature, so anthropology. Next, worldview needs to answer the question of the fall. The fall refers to a worldview's explanation of evil and suffering, or just to ask the question, what's gone wrong with the world, which is kind of the question we opened up with at the beginning of the podcast. And the third category is, again, from the biblical, the biblical vernacular of redemption. So it's to ask the question of, like, what's the agenda for reversing the fall and setting the world right again? Okay, so just quickly, I'm going to run through, like, basically four different worldviews. This will be very quick, but four worldviews answers to those questions. So, for example, in Marxism as a worldview, the creation or the origin answer is this, that the ultimate origin of everything is self-creating, self-generating matter. Okay, so then for the fall, or what went wrong, the world's problem is the rise of private property. And then the redemption, or how do we fix this, is revolution. It's overthrow the oppressors and recreate the original paradise of primitive communism. Okay, so then we'll use another, the New Age, the New Age worldview. So for creation, it'd be the origin of all things and ultimate reality is the absolute, the one, a universal spiritual essence. And then the fall, to describe what went wrong, is that the source of evil and suffering is our sense of individuality. Next, redemption is that, how do we fix this? Is that our problems will be solved as we reunite with the universal spiritual essence from which we all come from.
And that's also like more a Buddhist worldview or the pantheistic.
Yeah. Yeah, and then for atheism, so in terms of origin or creation, a self-originating universe and natural selection account for everything. And then for the fall, or what went wrong, pre-scientific, mystical, and religious systems brought irrational thinking and dangerous behavior. And then redemption, so how do we fix this? The world will be saved when all religion is debunked once and for all, and we accept that life is its own purpose. Okay, so then I wanted to sort of assess from the same grid the Bible's explanation. So for origin, it's that God created the earth and humans and everything in it. And so I just wanted to dive in here a little bit about that. And the purpose of doing that is to explain really the need, necessity, and benefit of having a cohesive worldview and what happens in a real lived experience if we're not operating out of a cohesive worldview. Okay, so in the Bible, I just described how it says that in terms of origin, that the universe was created by God and that humans are a piece of creation, part of his handiwork. So the implications of that are crucial. So for the Christian, that has bearing on our self-image. You know, it says that the Bible says no matter what we've done, no matter what your record is, it doesn't matter how low you've been, every human being is made in the image of God and thus reflects God and is therefore a rock solid, irreducible objective with glory and significance about you, and that every human being that's ever existed is such. Okay, so here's why something like that is crucial in terms of worldview when you're laying the grid over any worldview about creation, fall, and redemption. So there's, in terms of the realm of science, so there's absolutely no scientific basis for saying that a human person has dignity or worth or even rights prior to what the state decides. Science says that human beings are complex, but that there's no basis for assigning dignity or value to the human person. Bertrand Russell is known for saying that we're the product of causes that had no prevision of the end they were achieving. The hopes, fears, and loves of our minds are just the outcome of accidental collocation of atoms. Okay, so to go on, Oliver Wendell Holmes, junior chief justice and major intellectual, said, "Scientifically, I see no reason for attributing to a man a significance different in kind of that belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand, scientifically." So he says, "Scientifically, humans are complex, but significant? No." So, you know, speaking of natural selection, just the idea that nature kills us off just like everyone else. And this is a huge conundrum. And this is the point of saying all this, is because in our secular society, you know, in the realm of therapy and mental health counseling, you know, your therapist will tell you that you are so valuable and that you have such a dignity. And yet the philosophy of secularism, so shifting realms there, has absolutely no basis for that at all. G.K. Chesterton said this quote. He said, "As a politician, the secular person will cry out that all war is a waste of life." So, of course, meaning that life has value. "And then as a philosopher, admit that all life is a waste of time." Like, what's the point? "The secular person goes first to a political meeting where he complains that the natives are being treated as if they are beasts, and then goes to a scientific meeting where he proves that scientifically all humans are beasts." So, you know, in Christianity, because of the doctrine of the Trinity, where humans are created in the image of God, people have a tremendous value and worth that's grounded in reality, according to the biblical worldview. Just the idea that God didn't make junk. So again, this is just the implication of, you know, if you kind of have to do it yourself in terms of like worldview, where you pick and choose, like if you just have a secular worldview and there's no space there for God. So in the realm of science, there really is no basis for things like human rights that would be subjectively then imposed on that worldview. But most people who maintain a more secular and atheist worldview, for example, might take that position, but then all of a sudden dip into the philosophy that human beings have huge, that they matter, you know. So like, we know that, and then the realm of therapy, we say that, but then we dive back into science, and then there's no basis for human rights. And so it's just the idea that I think most of us want to believe about ourselves that we have a logical, like, you know, from one strand to the, you know, end of, you know, a rope or something to the other, that it's all lined up, that it's reasonable, that it's logical and cohesive. But sort of the point we're making is that an average person, unless the worldview is really well examined, can end up dabbling in different worldviews and not knowing it, just in order to kind of establish for themselves a baseline way of existing in the world that makes sense to them. It's a story that they need to live into to feel safe and good about life. But not all worldviews are created equal in that, it's tricky to have a cohesive worldview. So, yeah.
Totally. So if we're not living a worldview that is in line with full reality, then often that dissonance can lead to a lot of internal struggle and pathology. Therefore, a foundation must be rooted in reality and to align with the reality as we actually experience it. And the word reality assumes the existence of truth. We are living in what I would categorize as a post-truth society. I think it's probably gone far past even relativism at this point, where the concept of one truth is seen as oppressive or offensive. But over and over again, I am struck in my counseling practice by the power of truth. So one observation that I've made is I would say 99% of my clients, after some investigation and introspection, end up discovering that their most core wound, and this is the most common core wound I find, is a not enoughness or a lack of intrinsic worth, and often shame. So a way of understanding what our foundation actually is as it is right now would be to ask, what do you hold on to for your core source of worth? Or another way to look at it is, what do you hold on to when everything falls apart or is lost? Because it all can and will eventually be lost or fall apart. Many people to that question would say, well, I have myself, the self. But then, you know, why do we see all the suicide, the depression, the implosion? And the reality, I think, is that self-help, which is a exponentially growing
industry
and genre when you look in bookstores, self-help really only goes so far. One way to think about this is that water cannot rise above its source. So if the self is the ultimate, then there's nowhere else to go when we crumble, which we ultimately do and will. If you haven't experienced major tragedy or trauma or something like that in your life, you eventually will, and you'll be faced with this. Not to be too down, but that's the truth. So also what I notice is that over and over again in my practice, I'm really struck by this power of truth. And I've found that it is the single most valuable tool for reducing anxiety, for stopping fearful thought loops, for reducing depression by actually seeing the evidence for one's reasons to live or one's motivation to help what's wrong, etc. It's actually the most powerful therapeutic intervention that I have ever found. And it turns out that the truth actually will set you free. Later, you know, we'll look into that a little bit deeper and look at what truth is and define it more and the biblical version of truth and all of that. But it turns out that we really do need a cohesive worldview so that we're not in fragments. The culture now provides a sort of do-it-yourself worldview. My truth is my truth is your truth. You know, we get to put together bits and pieces of different things that we like that seem right to us based on our feelings, which happen to be a little bit fickle and they come and they go. So it results in our mental map being also fragmented. Our mental map is what helps us make meaning of what would otherwise be chaos. And so we're being fragmented based on these different quote unquote truths. So all of that is to say that truth matters, and it matters so much that it determines how we think, what we feel, the decisions we make, everything. And so that's why we really care about figuring out what it is.
Yeah.
Jenna has a really good quote for you.
Yeah, and the quote is just that the love of truth and the willingness to submit to its demands is the first step to developing a cohesive worldview. Yeah, and I mean, it's just really that idea that if there is such thing as truth, wouldn't we want to be the sort of people who submit even our opinions and feelings to its demands in order to move our lives into alignment with reality. And, you know, the laws of non-contradiction render the insistence that there is an impossibility that all truths can be true at the same time. And so that leaves us with a wall that we have to figure out what we're going to do with it. It's just that if there is something that is objectively true, that will bear down on our lives in one way or the other. And so we're really just making the point that to live congruent and in alignment with reality, in alignment with truth, is the best and most holistic recipe, essentially, for human flourishing.
So I just want to mention here that when Jenna was going through in the part one of this, going through the history of the formation factors. So there used to, you know, we used to have more cohesive family units and things like that to develop who we are and our value system and all of that. Back then, the ultimate goal of living used to be the pursuit of virtue. Mm-hmm. So Jenna can speak to what virtue is.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we throw around the word virtue, but really we're just talking about moral excellence and goodness. And I mean, so the difficulty with the idea of virtue, though, is that there had in previous generations been generally assumed definitions of what was morally right or what was considered morally wrong. And I think in part of one of the complexities we're up against right now in terms of virtue and morality is a departure from previous generations' understandings of the definition of what is right and wrong. And so the pursuit of virtue then becomes more difficult as the definitions are in ebb and flow with the waves of culture, you know, and the ever-changing definitions of that. So
yeah. So if we look at if the ultimate goal of living and the roadmap to healthy, happy, fulfilled life was the pursuit of virtue, fast forward to now, things have really changed. And I think it's really helpful to look at history in this way to actually see where we've come from and where we are now. Now, I would argue that the pursuit of happiness and a fulfilled life actually rests in the pursuit of just happiness or pleasure instead of virtue. So if you're just pursuing happiness, which happens to be a feeling, just like sadness, just like grief, just like, you know, frustration, feelings come and go. So the pursuit of happiness is a very unfair aim because we will always be let down. Because life is hard and it is up and down. And if we think we're supposed to be happy all the time, we're going to be really depressed because we're not going to be happy all the time. Yeah. Or if our pursuit is ultimately pleasure, like to have fun, to adventure, to enjoy life, you know, we can look at this through the worldview lens of like hedonism maybe, but and we'll talk more about the definitions of all these things. But if we're looking just for pleasure, then, I mean, you can see the outworking of that in our culture, right? We're looking at involving ourselves and all of our time in entertainment, in food, in drugs, in alcohol, in, you know, you name it, all sorts of pursuits of pleasure, which ultimately end up empty and are also fleeting.
Right. And I think also just to make the point that there is nothing actually wrong with the idea of pleasure and nothing wrong with the idea of happiness. In fact, those are beautiful parts of our humanity. It's, I think really where that becomes disordered is where pleasure becomes essentially sort of like a God substitute to lay that grid again over a worldview. It's that, it takes that place, if that is the primary purpose giver, then that is a version of a God substitute in worldview terms. And so the tricky thing, like she's describing with that, is things like pleasure and things like happiness as emotional byproducts are fickle. And that, so then the, what that renders essentially is that pleasure is a fickle God. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to base what we're sort of aiming at here is, you know, the basis of, you know, where, what you center and what you ground your roots in like as a, what you ground your roots in is, has to be something above yourself and outside of your emotional disposition and something that's, yeah, outside of the self essentially.
So if we look at, I mean, we can just think about the difference in everyday decisions that might grow from these two vastly different starting points, yeah, right? If our pursuit is for virtue, then, you know, we might make a very different decision than if our pursuit was pleasure.
Yeah.
But the thing is that happiness and pleasure actually can and do grow out of that life lived in pursuit of virtue, for example.
Yeah. And that's the, I think that's the irony of the flip flop, is that the pursuit of virtue was, so a moral goodness, had actually everything to do with this idea of doing what we ought to do as defined by our definitions of morality. And in doing so, it was directed and aimed at the common good and outside of the self instead of for the self. And so it's this really interesting inversion, whereas the pursuit of happiness or pleasure as the primary pursuit of life and the aim of life, it just turns out that that is not producing in us a long-standing, deep satisfaction and contentment, at least that that withstands a whole lifetime, because pleasure requires, and especially our understanding now in terms of neuroscience and neuroplasticity, anything that produces pleasure in us cannot actually be sustained. It will need increasing measures of that input in order to maintain it's just kind of an
the
interesting
release of dopamine.
Yeah.
So what we're getting at here is that ideas really do have real consequences in our lives and in culture. So we're making a case that that ideas and worldviews and the way we conceive of the world really matters.
Yeah.
So what we want to leave you with for now, before we come back with our next episode, is to just think about, what is your existing foundation? Yeah. What is the thing you hold on to when things get hard? What is the thing you are in pursuit of on a daily basis? What is your guiding principle? And really, what is your worldview?
Yeah. It's the, whatever, you know, what if the answer to those is not God, and if it's not that, usually each worldview will derive that from some aspect of creation itself, whether that's, material or spiritual or biological or empirical, you know, whatever it is, or relational. Yeah. That thing will become absolutized. And that will be the ground and the source for all else, and also accepted by faith, which is sort of ironic. But I think we just want to leave you with that question of, what is the ground and the source that you stand on through every up and down? And what is that thing? Is it capable of being removed? Is it something that is stable in and out of seasons of turmoil? Is it something that is actually rock solid, you know? And so, it's also kind of hard to ask those questions too sometimes, because if you're anything like me, and especially like in my younger years, I didn't intentionally ask myself these questions. It wasn't until, you know, life confronted me with these questions that all of a sudden it was like, wow, what do I actually believe about that? Where do I actually get my sense of worth and value from? And so anyway, we know that it's tough to ask those questions, but also it's so beautiful for the value that can come out of asking the big questions. Yeah.
So thank you for hanging in with us.
Yeah.
We're new to the podcasting world. We're finding our way. We just appreciate your time. If you've made it this far, thank you so much for listening and for your consideration of all of it.
Yeah.
We'll hopefully catch you next time.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Take care.